This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, he was religious and stuff. An Australian woman who followed her ISIS boyfriend into Syria talks exclusively to AM about what happened next.
I didn't want to be there anymore. For 2 years, I wanted to leave. But nobody understands that you cannot leave that place without money. And no money is allowed to be sent in. So you're kind of left in just a hole, you know? You're looking for a way out, and there was no way, other way out until somebody makes a way for you.
And a billion-dollar decision as the High Court puts a value on some extinguished native title. We look at why it may be the biggest ruling since Mabo. The US President Donald Trump has issued an emergency order grounding all Boeing 737 MAX 8s in the wake of the fatal crash in Ethiopia. It marks a significant turnaround for the United States, which has stood by the manufacturer in face of bans around the world, including in Australia. The Federal Aviation Administration says the decision comes after new evidence was collected at the crash site, as Thomas Aredi reports.
It marks a significant turnaround for the United States and one that could have huge implications for a giant in the aviation industry. But speaking this morning, President Trump wanted to make one thing clear.
Boeing is an incredible company. They are working very, very hard right now. And hopefully they'll very quickly come up with the answer. But until they do, the planes are grounded.
After the fatal crash involving a Boeing 737 MAX 8 in Ethiopia, the US initially chose not to follow other countries in their move to temporarily ground the planes. Now the Federal Aviation Administration in the United States has released this statement.
The agency made the decision as a result of the data gathering process and new evidence collected at the site and analysed today. This evidence, together with newly refined satellite data available to the FAA this morning, led to this decision.
The FAA says the grounding of the 737 MAX 8 and MAX 9 will remain in effect pending a further investigation, and that'll include an examination of the plane's flight recorders. President Trump added that a couple of other complaints were also behind the decision. He's raised his concerns with the FAA and Boeing itself.
They are all in agreement with the action. Any plane currently in the air will go to its destination and thereafter be grounded until further notice. So planes that are in the air will be grounded. If they're the 737 MAX, will be grounded upon landing at the destination. Pilots have been notified. Airlines have been all notified. Airlines are agreeing with this.
The plane is one of Boeing's signature products, and this is just the latest blow. Earlier, Canada made the same move. The country's transport minister, Marc Garneau, says the new information he's received could reveal similarities between the crash in Ethiopia and one involving the same type of plane in Indonesia last year.
This is new information that we received and analyzed this morning. It comes from validated satellite tracking data, suggesting a possible, although unproven, similarity in the flight profile of the Lion Air aircraft. And I caution that this new information is not conclusive and that we must await further evidence, hopefully, from the voice and data recorders.
Boeing says it continues to have full confidence in the 737 MAX, and now it's determined to reassure the public of the aircraft's safety.
Thomas Aredi reporting. Meanwhile, the Indonesian carrier Lion Air is putting a hold on deliveries of several new 737 MAX 8 planes. Lion Air already had concerns about the plane since an identical MAX 8 nosedived into the Java Sea last October, killing 189 people on board. Our Indonesia correspondent Anne Barker reports.
As Indonesia's fastest-growing airline, Lion Air is one of Boeing's biggest customers. It has orders on its books for 218 MAX 8 planes worth around $22 billion US dollars. Four of those were to be delivered this year, starting in April. But now that delivery has been suspended until Lion Air knows for sure what caused October's crash in Indonesia. We're asking Boeing and the National Transport Safety Committee to wait for the investigation to be finished, says Daniel Putut, Lion Air's managing director. So we're suspending delivery of several planes that were due this year because we want to know the root cause of that crash. In the months after the MAX 8 plane plunged into the Java Sea, Lion Air's owner, in fact, was examining the possibility of cancelling every one of those orders because he was reportedly angry that Boeing had blamed Lion Air for the crash. Clearly, that cancellation didn't go ahead. It may not have been legally or financially possible, and reports at the time suggested aircraft manufacturers rarely allow for such cancellations. But Sunday's plane crash in Ethiopia has revived Lion Air's concerns, and the airline isn't predicting what it may do beyond this delivery suspension. We're calling it a review, Daniel Putut says, not yet a cancellation. I emphasise it's not yet a cancellation. Ethiopia is now weighing whether to cancel its own order of MAX 8s, at least until the first results from the investigation into Sunday's crash. But not all experts agree the MAX 8 is necessarily flawed. One aviation specialist, Michael Planey, says it's wrong to make rash decisions.
There aren't enough data points now to pinpoint to a cause that would say that just this aircraft is flawed. We are seeing things that are concerning. They are worthy of investigation, but we just don't have data right now that says we could alleviate this problem with this particular aircraft because we don't know what the specific problem was.
The black boxes from last Sunday's crash will be sent to Europe for analysis, but it could be months before final results are known. This is Anne Barker in Jakarta for AM.
In the UK, the House of Commons has rejected an option for Britain to leave the EU without a deal. But that vote provides no answer to the question which has plagued politics since the referendum. What arrangement do the MPs and indeed the public at large actually want? We're joined by our Europe correspondent, Bridget Brennan, in London. And Bridget, what happened with the vote?
Well, Sabra, if you're having a hard time catching up on Brexit, you'd be forgiven because it was a chaotic and dramatic day in the Parliament again. Essentially, MPs were asked to rule out a no-deal Brexit. That's leaving the EU with no agreement in place, crashing out on the 29th of March. That's the Brexit deadline as it stands. And we've been told over and over what a calamity that could be for the economy and for industries in the UK to just leave the EU so quickly. And so that happened. MPs did rule that out. It's not a legally binding motion. But why it was embarrassing for Theresa May was that an amendment got up first saying that no deal should be taken off the table indefinitely. Theresa May's motion was somewhat softer, saying that the legal position could still stand, that a no deal be in place, and that if negotiations broke down, a no deal would be moved to beyond the 29th of March. But because the motion got up, she then tried to whip her own MPs to vote against the government's own motion because of that amendment that had come from a backbencher and it was passed by just four votes. And we know that some MPs abstained, at least one MP has resigned. A lot of upset people in the Parliament tonight. Another embarrassment for Theresa May because her own motion was essentially defeated by her own party.
Yeah, so what happens now?
Well, tomorrow MPs will now discuss what to do now. With this deadline approaching at just 16 days away, should MPs Brexit go to the EU and beg for a bit more time? But really, as Theresa May points out, as many members of the European Union have pointed out today, what then? Are they going to really be able to hammer out a new deal? And how long does the UK need to sort out this Brexit mess? Is it just a few months or is it years? Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar said those who are chasing Brexit are sort of chasing unicorns. So there's been some strong language and some clearly exasperated people within the EU saying this is now Britain's problem. They need to sort this out. The EU has given as much ground as it's going to. But let's perhaps have a listen back to some of the day's drama here in London. Along with hundreds of Brexit protesters, Barry Apps and Tony Clark have travelled from Somerset in southwest England to remind Westminster why they voted to leave the EU. They hate the idea of having to secure any kind of divorce deal with the Europeans.
So that we can just leave and then we can negotiate with them on the grounds that there's lots of things they want from us.
Yes, May is the most useless Prime Minister we've ever had, and she must go, really, quickly.
How do you think it's got to this mess, you know, after that historic vote? Did you anticipate it would end up like this?
No, May didn't want it in the first place, unfortunately, and she's just made it hang out and hang out.
Staunch Brexiteer John Barron is one of the Conservative MPs pushing for the UK to leave the EU immediately.
Has the time not come to look beyond this Westminster, this Remain-dominated Westminster bubble? No deal is better than a bad deal.
Most of those within the government would rather a more orderly Brexit. And if you need evidence of just how deep the divide is within the Tories, have a listen to the clearly exasperated MP Rory Stewart.
The big word here is compromise. And the unfortunate reality is there are still eight different positions in the House of Commons, and it's terrifying.
Labour's Liz Kendall believes this drawn-out deadlock needs to be handed back to the British people.
Because what is on offer now is so very different from what was on offer during the referendum, where people were promised we'd hold all the cards, we could have the exact same benefits, it would be the easiest trade deal in human history.
That's British Labour MP Liz Kendall ending that report by our Europe correspondent Bridget Brennan. Mike Rann is a former Australian High Commissioner to the UK and a former Labour Premier of South Australia. He's still based in London and is a visiting professor at the Policy Institute at King's College. He joined me earlier.
Well, what we're seeing basically is the collapse of the Prime Minister's authority, a collapse over her cabinet because they were able to vote in favour of things that were totally she opposed. So this cabinet solidarity has collapsed, party unity has collapsed, and what we're seeing basically is the Parliament taking the running of Brexit away from the government. So there's no support for the Prime Minister's deal. It's been voted down twice. So the next move, I think, what I'm being told around Westminster is that there is no support, no majority for any proposition, for any one of the deals, whether it's for a second referendum. The only thing that they're likely to support is for an extension of time. And so the next votes will be on that. And I would imagine, given that they're facing within 15 or 16 days, the crashing out of the EU, which would be a disaster for business in Britain, tomorrow there'll be a vote for an extension of time. And then, of course, the 27 individual countries of the EU have to decide whether that can happen and then have to decide the length of time that they'll give Britain to sort themselves out.
What strikes you about the state of the parties right now and their leaders?
Well, essentially, you've got a situation in the Labour Party where Jeremy Corbyn is opposed by 70 to 80% of his own MPs, but is locked in because of support from unions and also from the party structure because of a change of the rules. You've got a Prime Minister who, they rather uncharitably say is sort of dead woman walking. She's already said she won't contest the next election. And what I find from talking to Tories is that all they want to talk about is who the next leader is, but they don't want to spoil that leader by putting them in before essentially this current business is settled. So, and then when you ask them, well, who will be the next Conservative leader, one by one, they'll give you a different name. So they haven't sorted out who they want to replace Theresa May. There's a bit of a movement to stop Boris Johnson. And meanwhile, we're seeing people falling away from resigning from both parties. What we're seeing basically is the collapse of Westminster traditions day by day. And the Prime Minister essentially, I think, is finished. And what they're trying to do is to work out what next.
How does this end? I mean, one of the papers there has headlined today that Parliament is flirting with economic self-harm.
Yeah, well, I think essentially Britain voted for self-harm because most people didn't really know what they were voting for. I mean, the most Googled words the next day in Britain after that they voted to narrowly to get out of the EU was, what is the EU? And what happened is that I went to a number of the meetings where I heard British ministers saying, these negotiations will be easy, we will play the EU for a break, there's 27 of them, we'll be divide and rule. Well, they haven't divided, they've been totally consistent. The only people who have been divided have been the British, and the negotiations have been inept. And so you now have a situation where the head of the CBI, which is the national industry body, has come out and said, within 16 days, Britain faces a sledgehammer blow to its economy with massive tariffs put up against it, and that we deserve better governments than this. And I think that what you're seeing is essentially the collapse of trust in parliamentary processes, collapse of trust in government and in the party system. So it's not looking good. The EU doesn't want Britain to crash out. But what the EU is saying to Britain is, tell us what you want. We're hearing what you don't want. Tell us what you want, and then we negotiate. The problem is, as I said before, there's no majority support around any single proposition at this stage. And so the cliff edge gets closer and, 16 days away.
And that's Mike Rann, former Australian High Commissioner to the UK. You're listening to AM. An Australian member of the Islamic State group now living in a refugee camp in Syria says her six-month-old daughter is seriously ill and needs food and hospital care. The woman says she wants to bring her two children back to Australia. Middle East correspondent Adam Harvey filed this exclusive report from northern Syria.
Among 30,000 IS family members now living in two refugee camps in northern Syria, there's at least three Australians, this woman and her two young children.
My husband got killed and I was just looking for a way out. Okay. And then when the way was made out, I got my bag and I took my kids and I came.
She wouldn't give her name and wears a veil, but it's believed she's Zehra Duman. Her story perfectly matches that of the then 19-year-old who left Melbourne in 2014 to follow her boyfriend to the so-called Islamic State.
Yeah, he came before me. He came 6 months or something before me, and then I started speaking to him online, got back in contact with him. He was religious and stuff, and I came after him.
They married in Raqqa in early 2015. He died 5 weeks later. Duman was a strident supporter of IS on social media, posting images of her and other Australian women holding automatic weapons. This woman says she had a change of heart.
I didn't want to be there anymore. For 2 years I wanted to leave, but nobody understands that you cannot leave that place without money, and no money is allowed to be sent in. So you're kind of left in just a hole, You're looking for a way out, and there was no way, other way out until somebody makes a way for you.
Now she's escaped the besieged enclave in Baghouz. She says her life is awful.
I have two kids. I have a son, he's 2.5 years old, and a daughter, she's 6 months old. My daughter is very malnutritioned and she's like anorexic, very skinny. I have no money. I'm not allowed to have money. No one gives me money here. No one gives me food. They don't give us food. They don't give us anything here. They don't let us contact our families. I don't know what to do now. My daughter needs milk. I want to go to the hospital. They don't let me go to the... We go to the gate. I want to go to the hospital. My daughter's sick. Oh, we can't take you to the... No one can go to the hospital. They start shooting guns in the air and I don't know what.
She desperately wants to go home.
I want to go back to my country. Obviously, I think everybody's asking for that because, I'm an Australian citizen, and I think I have, not just me, but my kids have a right to at least be, treated like normal kids, hospital, medicine, food, here, wallahi, my kids don't even have, my daughter needs milk. Do you believe my daughter needs milk right now? And I have no money to buy her milk. Well, nobody really cares about us here. And I understand what the anger that they have towards a lot of us here, but the kids don't need to suffer about this.
The woman believed to be Zehra Duman says she's had no contact with Australian authorities.
Nope, I've only seen journalists. I only see journalists. I've not seen any embassy or anything. All I just hear is we don't know what's happening.
Authorities in northern Syria have been overwhelmed by the IS family members who've come out of Baghouz. They say they provide 3 meals a day to the women and children, and they're doing their best to give basic medical care. But the Kurdish authorities say they desperately need help from Western nations, and they want countries like Australia to step up and take back their citizens. This is Adam Harvey in Qamishli, northern Syria, for AM.
And in news to hand, it's clear Zara Duman won't get much sympathy from Scott Morrison. The Prime Minister spoke a short while ago.
They have to take responsibility for those decisions to join up with terrorists who are fighting Australia. Now, I'm not going to put any Australian at risk to try and extract people from those situations. They have made their decisions. And if they're Australian citizens, and if they are Australian citizens, well, there is a process for us to deal with them under Australian law. And they will face the full force of Australian law if should they be in a position to seek to come back to Australia.
Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, faces 7.5 years in prison after being sentenced in a second court case. The charges relate to conspiracy and obstruction of justice for illegally working as a foreign agent, witness tampering, and building a massive wealth through money laundering. Washington correspondent Zoe Daniel reports.
The sentence in DC's district court, added to last week's penalty in Virginia, adds up to about 7.5 years in jail, a bit less with time served and potential good behaviour. The case was brought by the special counsel investigating possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. And Paul Manafort's lawyer, Kevin Downing, was keen to claim it as confirmation that there was none. Protesters outside court shouted him down.
Judge Jackson conceded that there was absolutely no evidence of any Russian collusion in this case. So that makes two courts have ruled no evidence of any collusion with any Russians.
That's not what she
Part
said.
Number two.
Indeed, that's not what the judge said. She said the question of Russian collusion was not presented in this case. Period. The case was about Paul Manafort's illegal work for Ukraine as an unregistered foreign agent, laundering millions in related funds and trying to get witnesses to lie about it. It's hard to overstate the number of lies and the amount of fraud, the judge said. What you were doing was lying to members of Congress and the American public, she said, of his lobbying work when being paid by a foreign government. And he did it, she said, not to support a family, but to sustain a lifestyle at the most opulent level possible and to buy more suits than one man can wear. The defence had argued that the charges were political, saying, but for a short stint as a campaign manager in a presidential election, I don't think we'd be here today. The judge said the Justice Department was already investigating Ukrainian lobbying before the special counsel was even appointed. There was mixed reaction on Capitol Hill. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
This is a man close to 70. He's going to be punished for his crimes, and a 7-plus-year sentence is probably a pretty good chunk of reasonable life expectancy. In that regard, it's a tough sentence, and some will say it's not tough enough. But from my point of view, the courts worked.
Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal.
Paul Manafort caught a break. This overall sentence is exceedingly lenient.
Just after the sentencing, the New York Attorney's Office indicted him on 16 counts of residential mortgage fraud and other felonies. A guilty verdict in a New York state court would end any chance of a pardon for the former lobbyist. In Washington, this is Zoe Daniel reporting for AM.
Now to a High Court ruling that's been described as the most important since the Mabo ruling in the early 1990s. Lawyers say it could cost Australian governments billions in compensation. The courts ordered the Northern Territory government to pay $2.5 million in compensation to a group of native title holders in Timber Creek for the loss of their rights. Eleanor Whitehead reports.
Native title holders in the Northern Territory town of Timber Creek spent years fighting for compensation.
We took us that long, 19 years, to get to where we are. And, you know, we're happy with the outcome now.
Lorraine Jones was one of the lead claimants representing the Ngarluru and Ngali people. In a landmark ruling, the High Court has ordered the Northern Territory government to pay $2.5 million in compensation for the loss of their native title rights. That included $1.3 million for the loss of spiritual connection to country, a decision which Lorraine Jones welcomes.
Mainly our concern is with the cultural loss. Without this culture, you're nothing.
Their claim related to a sliver of land between Katherine and Kununurra, where native title rights were extinguished when the government built roads there in the 1980s and 1990s. This was the first time the High Court has examined how to compensate native title holders for the loss of those rights or put a price on the cultural harm caused. Tony Denholder, a partner at the law firm Ashurst, calls it an historic ruling.
This is the most important decision since Mabo came down in 1992. Now we have the courts for the first time telling us how much native title is worth when it's been extinguished or impaired by acts of government.
The Timber Creek native title holders were originally awarded $3.3 million in compensation by a federal court in 2016. But that was challenged by the Northern Territory and federal governments, who argued the native title rights were overvalued, while the High Court reduced the total compensation to $2.5 million. Lawyers say it broadly upheld the lower court's decision. Tony Denholder argues the final ruling sets an important precedent, which could open the doors to hundreds of compensation claims across the country.
You will have application to approximately 375 native title groups. On a conservative basis, compensation could equal at least $1 billion, but more realistically, it will be in the billions of dollars. We are talking about the myriad of acts of government on land across the country since 1975.
Pastoral and mining companies could face compensation claims as well as governments. In a statement, the Minerals Council of Australia had this to say.
Governments across Australia should work with all affected stakeholders, business, Indigenous communities, local government and other bodies, to provide investment and policy certainty so the minerals industry can continue to support local jobs and development.
For native title holders in Timber Creek, it's time for celebration. They say they'll decide as a family group how to use their money.
Eleanor Whitehead with that report. The United States government has banned its agencies from using products made by the Chinese tech giant Huawei, and the company's been blocked from Australia's 5G network on security grounds. But the West Australian government is continuing full steam ahead with a Huawei-built communication system for Perth's train network. From Perth, Eliza Borello reports.
When the US Justice Department announced fraud charges against Huawei in January, the WA government promised to review the $200 million contract it signed with the Chinese tech giant. The contract is for a new digital radio system for Perth's metro trains. The review is now done, and the WA Transport Minister, Rita Saffiotti, says the project will go ahead.
The Huawei UGL representatives confirmed they would be able to source equipment required for the project. The state government will continue to monitor this contract with the involvement of other key state agencies.
WA's Shadow Transport Minister, Lisa Harvey, remains wary.
She hasn't addressed the security issues, the safety issues.
A lot's happened since the WA government inked its Huawei deal last July. Apart from the US Justice Department allegations, the Australian government banned the company from the rollout of the nation's 5G mobile infrastructure on national security grounds. Tom Uren is an analyst with the Australian Strategic Policy Institute Cyber Centre, and he argues it may have been too difficult for the WA government to sever ties with Huawei.
I think once contracts are signed, it's always hard to get out of them unless there are a sort of get-out clauses written in before. And I think the allegations in the indictments about Huawei are just so unexpected that they're not the sort of things that you would normally write into a contract beforehand.
Looking at this from, I guess, an outsider's perspective, there had been rumblings about Huawei. The West Australian government made their decision to proceed with this contract knowing that the federal government was deciding whether Huawei would get access to the 5G network. Do you feel there's been some kind of naivety here on the part of the West Australian government?
I don't know that they've been naive. I think there's different levels of government have different access to intelligence information, and I think that's really informed the federal government a lot. So I think they're probably trying to make the best of a bad situation in that I think if they had their time over with all the information that's available now, they probably would have chosen a different contractor.
In a statement, a Huawei spokesman said it is the world's largest provider of telecommunications equipment and has reached this position by being a trusted and innovative company. He added Huawei is delivering communications technology to rail projects in Europe and Asia and has been involved with Sydney's metro rail system for close to 10 years.
Eliza Borello reporting, and in a statement, the WA Transport Minister, Rita Saffiotti, said national security agencies have confirmed the contract hasn't raised security concerns because it's for a closed network carrying non-sensitive information. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Angela Voipierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley.
And we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. And today's episode is all about the jail sentence handed to George Pell for his child sex offences.
For a lot of people, the 6 years with a non-parole period of 3 years and 8 months was nowhere near enough.
Yeah, so we wanted to know, how does this measure up next to similar cases? And how do judges arrive at a specific jail term? How much is maths and how much is instinct?
That's The Signal. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts every weekday morning.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.